So I'm Sean Cribbin, and I'm with Chris Gordon on Hellblazer Biz.
Hi, I'm Steve Sauter, and I'm with Chris Gordon on Hellblazer Biz.
Everyone, I have the honor, or the extreme honor and privilege, of the company of Sean Cribbin and Steve Sauter this evening. Sean Cribbin is the main subject of a new documentary that is coming out, which premiered in London and Canada last night, which is Was I Next? For people in Canada, they do know that is a very big story, and it's just we'll get into that, because I mean, when I've read through the information, the story of what your experiences were, Sean, it was really harrowing, and obviously, you know, to say the least. So it is actually a very big honor. I say you are a survivor of a serial killer from Canada, basically. For people who don't know, I did actually reach out to a Canadian friend of mine and texted and said, I'm speaking to you. And I go, oh my God, really? Oh, wow. It was because I was just like, they knew the whole story completely. So yeah, this is an actual privilege for me to actually talk to you. And speak to you. I say normally it's a documentary that you've had made with Billy, who sadly can't join us this evening. Just have a general chat basically about your experiences and making the documentary itself and how you feel now, and obviously things that you were going through at the time, etc.
Okay, where would you like me to start?
I can let you start if you wish. So, talk right back to the beginning. I mean, the whole story. I mean, Steve, I know you've been involved as well from that side as well, but it's take me through it, Sean. Go on.
Okay, so it's I guess the start day is really the 26th of July, 2017. I went with a gentleman named Bruce MacArthur. He was arrested 6 months later and charged at that time with two counts of first degree murder for Andrew Kinsman and Celine Essen. And this is when I saw that the news announced they caught a serial killer. And when I saw his picture, that's when I realized, oh, well, I had a date with him about 6 months ago. And that night, I went back and forth in my head over my memory of that day. And I thought, well, nothing out of the ordinary happened. So I don't think I have to call the police, but if they feel there's anything, they'll contact me. And the next morning, the phone rang, and it was the Toronto Police, and they said I had vital information for the case. And so if I would please come in, and I went down. And that's when I learned that I had a large chunk of my memory missing from that day, because they had evidence in their possession that I was knocked unconscious. I was then handcuffed to the bed. A hood was put over my head. Duct tape was put over my eyes. And he was posing my body in a position ritualized to his MO. And he had the murder weapon up against my throat, and the murder weapon had the DNA of the two gentlemen I just mentioned on it, as well as my DNA. And that's when I learned that he'd started to kill me. Now, if I go on the events of that day, all I remember is waking up, or not even waking up. I thought I missed a blip of a nanosecond. No one told me I had passed out. So I just heard his roommate was in the apartment. And I said, maybe we should do this another day. And I left. And so that was my rendition at that time. But it was his roommate came home 24 hours before he was scheduled. MacArthur thought he was coming home the next day. So that would have given him ample time to do what he did to the other people, which was then let me regain consciousness. Then torture me, some sexual things, and shaved their head hair and their face hair, because he kept it all in Ziploc bags of all the different men. And then he would roll you in the carpet of his bedroom and take you to his workshop, which was at a Mallory Crescent. It was a house because he was a landscaper. And there he dismembered the bodies and he buried them in flower planters. That's where I would have been laid to rest, I guess. And there was evidence that he went back inside the pots and after they were buried and then manipulated with them. What did they do? He would basically play with the pieces. And that's kind of how my whole... So it was 6 months of not knowing, and then all of a sudden I was thrown into that situation. And that's where kind of my trauma took off. And that's kind of the documentary starts into the meat of it at that point, because I was oblivious up until that point, but learning had as much trauma as if I had been aware from the very beginning, because it was your mind just goes ballistic and starts running all the scenarios, because it was pure luck and that all the events lined up that day to make that combination for that narrow window to escape.
Yeah, sounds it. And that's what I got from reading from it. It's the coincidence and luck is the words that I used quite often for the fact that this guy, Jimmy MacArthur's roommate, just came back that early. I'm glad he did, because obviously I'm here to talk to you about it. Yeah. And that experience and the fact that, sadly, obviously the others didn't have that luck to go through. As you can hear, it's affecting me just listening to that story and thinking, my God, I couldn't picture myself in that kind of a situation. And I mean, it's definitely like a PTSD that you would have got, because hearing the fact that you said it was because you had that GHD and the high levels of it as well, you just didn't know. And for you, it was just like, it's just like you're off and then back up again. Just that minute. And it's 6 months gone by where you were living in a, not in bliss, but in blissful ignorance in a way that you didn't, what goes on. And then all of a sudden, whamf. I can see how that could tear things
and
right up.
And when they're asking, the police were asking me questions, it was when you were like trying to recall and then you realize you have no memory of it. Like there's a blank. That's when you realize there's empty spots, and that's very, very troubling. Because then I did my best to piece as much of what was in the blank spots. And the police helped. Like I got timestamps of when I entered and when I left. I was able to figure out how long I was unconscious. And then the photographs filled in what was going on while I was unconscious. And the roommate helped. I was able to get in touch, because the police don't give out names of people in the case. We were able to find him, and we had him and his partner over for dinner. And this was just the day before the lockdown, I think. And he came. They came, and as soon as he came in, I cried and hugged him. And he didn't feel heroic, but I just, like, how could I not see him?
He was unaware of what was happening.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it was completely, it was as much a shock to him as it was to everybody else. What has happened, like, and people kept saying to us, how could you be a roommate in there and not know that somebody was killing, people in your house? But it's possible. Like, I mean, he never did any of the killing at the place. He always elsewhere. And so
that he was away for weekends.
Yeah. He was,
I was going to say, it sounds like he was tiny, the situation fell in MacArthur's hands, as bad as that is, in the fact that, he had this, he had time days at a time where he could just do these sickening, horrible things. When his roommate's not there, and you're right, because the roommates, you can't blame the roommate for not knowing, because what you've just explained, he had a workshop where he did other bits and pieces, and it was, the photographs obviously in the apartment, but if he's not there, how do you know? So I can just imagine. Yeah. It's probably a great relationship
he built up. That he thought he might have come home early on another occasion, because he couldn't understand why, because Bruce was so angry that he'd come home. It's not, there were roommates. It wasn't, there was no obligation to notify him. It was his apartment. He said, but his temper was way off. Great. And he wonders if it was on the timing of when either another one had just been killed or something like that. But it's kind of his psychological, he's going through just as bad as everyone else involved in this thing.
I was going to say, it's really good that you actually reached out to him and you've been able to form that friendship with you all as well to sort of, it's a shared experience basically that you've got someone who was there. And because I don't have any, this is not in that your particular instance, there's probably, not that many in your scenario, but through like a PTSD type scenario, a lot of people face it alone. So have you found that being able to speak with him and have that friendship build up that you've both been able to mutually support as well?
Yeah, and I reached out to the victim who was he was the one that charged MacArthur at the very beginning because he got attacked and hit on the head with a pipe outside his apartment. I reached out to him online, and when I did, he gushed because he was the first one we know of to have this encounter. He did press charges. MacArthur did get sentenced, but all that record was wiped away because he applied for a pardon.
He had his record expunged. So,
I reached out to this man, he just he said he felt so alone up until that point. And
So there was a history. There's two other people that were attacked. And you got away and the police, were in the first case, they investigated it. He was charged. He was given some probation. He had to stay out of the gay village, that kind of stuff. But 2 years after that, he had his record expunged so that there was nothing there. So when the second person, this was, a couple of years later, went to the police, that he where he nearly been strangled in Bruce McCarthy's van.
It was like a first offense.
The cops, it was like a first offense, exactly. And he turned himself in and said, well, it was just like a lover's spat, and they just let him go.
No charges were pressed.
So it was like, there's some mistakes that were made on everybody's part, but I think, it's not because the police are incompetent. It's because, he was pretty clever.
I was going to say, to be able to get your record expunged as well, that's,
it's you've changed law now. Violent offences cannot.
Right. I don't know how that works. It must be different, obviously, before in Canada, because I don't think that can happen over here either. You can't expunge. You might be able to. I've never been in trouble. So, he's obviously got to have had some gift of the gab to be able to do stuff like that and get that. Speak to the right people with connections and things to do that. So there are instances where you've just got a whole cacophony of situational circumstance which leads to something like this happening. And so when you in hindsight, you can pick up everything here and here, but at the time it is a difficult thing to pick up.
Well, the other thing too that he did was picked his victims carefully, right? He went for people who were new immigrants to Canada, who were living in the gay village that came from Middle Eastern countries and places where being gay isn't sort of
frowned upon. Acceptable.
So they wouldn't have connections with their families. They were too new to the country to have friends and people who would notice them missing. So he picked his victims based on him not really getting a lot of attention, right? He was very, very, very clever about that. In fact, the thing is that he used to wait outside of English as a second language courses, that were put on by the city for new immigrants to help them learn English to find his targets, right? So there was several of the victims that weren't even ever reported missing, right? So it was just, it was very, very, very evil.
That's very predatory. It's like the atypical when you start thinking about a predator type thing going out and targeting. That's just sounds exactly like what he's done. And again, in hindsight, when you can see it all happening, it's in the background, it's great. So it just knocks me for six. I'm sorry, it's just times you're talking about. That's how open this is. And so how did you meet Billy then? Because obviously you've had your own experience and you've gone through and you are still going through that. You know, obviously the trauma that I can fully appreciate is something that's going to, it's something that is going to be ongoing for a while. Obviously it does help if things fade. Obviously you've got Steve there as well to help and push yourselves a lot, you know, yourself along and overcome as best as you can, but it's something that never will be overcome. It's always going to be at the back of your mind, I think.
Yeah.
So with regards to the documentary coming along, how did they get in touch with Billy, or how did Billy get in touch with you? Okay. So
Billy goes back 23 years prior to this event. His life circumstances put him in a situation where he ended up homeless.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the wintertime, and he used to work with an ex of mine that I was with at the time in a bar. I found out that he was homeless, and I told my partner, my ex-boyfriend, to tell him he could move into, we had a solarium, like, which was an extra room. And mm-hmm. He moved in. I was the only one working, so I guess I provided for everyone. That stuck in his memory. I forgot all this. Like, I kind of, like, just fell off. Because
yeah.
After Billy left our place, he was there for 3 months, he said. He then went back to his hometown. He got sort of his life together. And mm-hmm. he started to make contacts and connect skills that he felt he could do this. And when he approached me, he said, I had helped him out in such a way, it made such a difference in his life, and wanted to do this for me. And it was, he's come through on everything he promised. And I was being approached by other people like the BBC and NBC, but he was just so passionate about making sure I was safe and during the process that I said, okay, let's do it. We went ahead.
Fantastic. And I mean, in documentary as well, it's obviously, as well as yourselves, you've got, I think some lifelong or almost lifelong friends of like Brian and his wife Elise as well. They sort of interview to, they come into it, and you've got, is it Catherine McDonald? She covered it on the report, wasn't it? The new reporter. Yeah. So, you know, so I guess you get a nice wide spectrum of people to actually come in and from different angles. Dave Dickinson as well, because he was the one who eventually oversaw the whole thing, wasn't he? And yeah. Caught him, which is, you know, so I take it these guys, are you still in touch with all of these people yourselves?
Catherine, it was funny because when the original interview was done, it was because someone had leaked my name. I did it independently with a friend of mine. And mm-hmm. then he kind of went to the news agencies because I had certain conditions. I didn't want the sex side highlighted as much because I thought right. it would distract. And it does. So Global, the one that Catherine works for, they went ahead and got this kind of the exclusive rights to the story. And she had been the one who kind of ran the story, but she never met me personally.
Okay.
Until then a year later, I was in court and she was in the courtroom and I saw her. So I just, she'd always been like, I heard her on radio and different TV shows talking about me. And it was always mm-hmm. so supportive and positive that, which a lot of other people weren't always that way. So I went up to her and I just said, Catherine McDonald. And she turned and she was very excited to see me. But at the same time, then she turned away and said, don't look at me. Cause she didn't want the other reporters. Cause it was jam packed with reporters.
Right. Yeah.
Interest. And then that's when we met. And then she interviewed me the day after sentencing and stuff. And we go out for dinner every once in a while. And she wrote the foreword for the book that we're going to put out.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. That was announced last night, isn't it? We can talk about that as well, can't we? Because I had the Mark mentioned it. So you've got so obviously you're writing a book about this as well, about your experiences with the story. And am I allowed to mention the film rights or not? Did that get mentioned or not? Mark mentioned it briefly.
There's some people have signed on to the project.
Right. Okay.
That's as far as I know.
Okay. I might just take that little bit out because I'm not sure how much we're supposed to. But the book deal, obviously, you doing that as a joint venture between the both of you writing the book, or have you got? Are you going to have someone else?
I wrote the book over COVID.
Okay.
Because it's a little different because it's more of a factual as it was happening. So I went back to therapeutic journals. I ended up as one chapter, the police emails and my correspondence during that year. I just put in the emails almost so you can see the story develop between our relationship.
Yeah.
I talk about my family and their participation, like how different people reacted and then how the public reacted positively and then the negative. Because there was big online debates that I deserve to die.
Really?
Yeah. Because they felt that I was, because there were drugs involved they felt I was cheating on my partner, which is not true because we have a relationship.
Yeah.
But as it was seen from the outside, it was people.
Yeah. When the first interview went public, Global put it up on YouTube and I told Sean, stay off of YouTube. Don't go look at the comments. Don't, because everybody knows YouTube is the basement of the internet. And some of the comments were horrible. And so for 2 weeks, I just sat on YouTube, like defending his honor. Right. You know, and it was, you know, it was, yeah, there was a lot of nastiness on there. You know, people that, you know, just, well, he didn't finish the job and right. You know, it was just like, yeah, it was terrible. And you know, trolls are everywhere, right? You know, I mean, that kind of stuff doesn't help, you know, when, especially when you've got, you know, PTSD and, you know, night terrors and all this kind of stuff going on as well. You know, the last thing you need is to have this, you know, sort of, you know, false idea that, you know, that everybody's against you, right? You know, I mean, it's not, that's why the documentary was very good, I think, for Sean, because he got to sort of be with people whose lives he had affected positively, right? You know?
Yeah.
And he kind of, and he called it his
my wonderful life.
It's a wonderful life moment, right? You know, where he kind of got to understand how, you know, how he had changed other people's lives, and I think that's useful. It helped definitely a lot, right? You know, I mean, it's still there. It's still, you know, I mean, it still comes up every now and then. There's an occasional night terror and that kind of stuff, you know, that we deal with, but it's but I think that overall the documentary has been very healing for it.
Yeah.
Excellent. I mean, that your analogy of it's a wonderful life moment is lovely. of coming through and it's nice to focus on that positivity, because you're right, Steve, the trolls. I think social media is a blessing and a curse, because I gave up Twitter quite a lot. And I keep coming back because I've been able to promote my show. So that's the only reason I stay on it now, because I'll just once or twice I'll delve into something. And the hate and vitriol that I can't stand it. It's just
people say things on there that they would never ever say in real life to somebody alive.
Keyboard warriors, because they can sit behind a keyboard anonymously, or so they think anonymously, and do stuff. Like, I actually had one on my YouTube the other day from the last interview I did, which was a great interview about a film called Prize Fighter. And it was like, it wasn't a nasty one. It was just like, what an absolutely terrible interview. You've made an interesting subject sound the most dullest going. I was just like, cheers. So, delete.
Thank you. That's the only thing you can say at that point. It's like, it's not worth engaging.
I know, exactly. I just clicked delete, to be fair. It was on me. Power of YouTube of owning a video. Yeah. Delete the comment. But I mean, that wasn't a nasty one, but I can only imagine the kind of, what you've mentioned. I'm not going to go into it because it's not, I don't want to drag that kind of thing up, but the things that you've mentioned, I couldn't even imagine of having to deal with when you're actually dealing with your own situation of going through that PTSD and it hitting you all the time. It's just wrong. But it's great to hear that the documentary, and obviously writing the book as well, I can imagine how therapeutic that would have been. Because you
have to publish some of the haters' comments and call them out on it.
Excellent. Yeah, make them famous. You know, and stuff like, it's just it's one of those. It's so to get that kind of therapy through that, and obviously you've got a really strong partner in Steve there as well to help you through, and friends, you know, lots of friends to go. It's you know, it's something you know, I really hope you will get through, because I mean, talking to you, you're both fantastic guys. It's great, you know, it's honored to privilege to actually get to talk to you about all of this. I'm kind of getting lost for words, to be honest, purely because of this, the situation of what it is. It beggars belief that anyone could do anything like Bruce did, to be honest. And
like, I mean, yeah, like cutting people up and putting them in planters, that's pretty extreme, right?
You know, it is. But, you know, I mean, there's one thing about doing that, you know, going out and killing someone, but then it's that ritualistic side of it.
And then dress them up and dismember them. And,
yeah, like, that's just awful. What kind of mindset do people must have to actually go?
And he's not talking. I get reports on him every once in a while, and like he was within 3 months of being sentenced, he was beaten up in prison to the point where he had to go to the infirmary for a while. But since then, the reports is he doesn't talk to inmates, he doesn't talk to guards, he doesn't talk to anyone. He just smiles and walks around, and they're actually a little bit nervous about this he's not socializing, he's not and he's never talked about the psychological like stuff behind what motivated him, because I was allowed to submit questions to him, and he never answered.
Yeah, that's just, I don't know if that's, I'm trying to think if that's more narcissistic or sociopathic. I'd say it's more sociopathic, because, you know, I've got narcissistic's the other side of the ex-president of America, but, you know, I'm not going in there. Yeah. But very sociopathic. If he's not talking as well, that's, and if people in the actual prison are afraid of him as well, because of that, and, you know, and they're just worried that he's not, what's he going to do? Exactly. It's like they're obviously watching him.
Yeah.
And the fact that they've got this, well, it's a good thing, because one, you know, he's behind bars.
Well, I think that he's doing that for a reason, though. Like, yeah. I mean, it's the same reason that I think he did why he pled guilty to all 8 charges in order to forego a trial, right?
Mm.
Like, there was that would have been the trial of the century in Toronto, but he, you know, he just pled guilty to all 8 charges, and that was it. Went to prison, you know, and it was and you know, people were like, oh well, he pled guilty, out of personal guilt or whatever. No, he did that. He did that to avoid his family getting dragged into it, probably because he had an ex-wife and 2 kids and grandkids, right? You know, and also I think because you don't start serial killing at age 66, right? I mean, if you think about it, you know, the standard, you know, sort of the behavior that psychologists would say is normal is you start much younger than that, and that becomes a lifelong sort of thing, right? And so, and there are lots of examples of gay people in the gay village gone missing that go all the way back to the 1970s that are unsolved, right?
Right.
And so, you know, so I don't believe that, I think that he pled guilty and got the thing done with so that there was not going to be any further investigation into his past. Stuff in his past, there may be hundreds of bodies we don't know about, right?
Well, yeah, that's quite sure. I didn't realize it's 66. So that you're right, because that's, yeah, that's, it's just very calculated. He sounds very cold, very calculated. It's not someone who I'd, from listening to all this, that I would say was out of his mind the way they're, obviously some people might think if he's not talking, etc. No, that's, it's just like you just said, that's a very calculated and deliberate decision and a deliberate ploy.
Yeah. He was well known in the gay community in Toronto as well. Like, I mean,
right.
You know, I had some ties to him myself from years ago, right? A good friend of mine was a landscaper as well, who worked with him at one point. And
yeah,
you know, so it was definitely, you know, something where, you know, people knew him, and it was a shock, you know, that people were like, oh, okay. I mean, cause he was a mall Santa, for heaven's sakes. It was really difficult to sort of, you know, rectify those 2 things, and you know, so yeah, obviously, you know, he lived a double life, right? yeah
that's, it's just, oh god, just,
it's imagine terrifying, because you never know. Like, I mean,
no, because like you just say, more Santa, you know, someone you think was a really good guy and everything like that, and you It's making me, it makes me think now that
he trusted him.
Yeah.
Right? You know, Sean went with him without even really worrying about it. Right. You know,
mm-hmm.
And he was to the point where he didn't tell, like, cause I was at the office the day that this happened. And he didn't, tell me that he was going to be going with him because it was just a last minute thing. And he thought, oh, I'll tell him when he gets home from work, whatever. Mm-hmm. Cause he had no qualms about it at all.
Yeah.
And he did, when he got back home, he told me about it and said, well, I think it was a bad date. We talked it up wasn't very comfortable and forgot about it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now afterwards, of course, Sean has all of the trauma that he's dealing with. Right. I just kind of kept flashing on me coming home from work that day and just never seeing Sean again.
Not knowing
what happened, that would have been horrible. Right.
Because it's, it's Sean is obviously the main one affected, but yourself, it's just something I think, if you can think of that and just think the non-closure that you would have ever had, I can see where that thought is, going to be coming backwards and backwards and backwards as well. I don't want to keep dragging it up because I don't want to just go,
things happen out of sequence during I was already, then I knew what was going on. And then they found the remains of the others, of everyone. And when they found that first pot, I said to Steve, I said, that's where I would have been, right there. Like, I knew it because of the timeline of where it was mm-hmm. around Andrew. I that creeped me out for quite a while. Like, to know the exact spot you were, someone had intended you to be, and you missed it by.
That's just luck.
Yeah,
it's just, it's just absolutely shocking. And it's great, the fact to hear that you both, you are able to talk about something like this as well and open about what went on and what happened as well. It's a warning to other people as well out there, just to always be vigilant and always watch. You can, it doesn't matter who you are and it doesn't matter who's out there. Just don't trust all the time. It's just, it is. Yeah. It's very much so. It's what I went back to. I think, I don't think COVID's helped either. I think COVID seems to have changed humanity quite a lot as well. And because it's insulated people even more, but in a way, I guess it makes more people and more watchful of other people, I guess, in a way. So, in that respect, but I think there's also a lot of humanity's been taken out in past few years. The way, I don't know what it is. I don't know what's about society. I'm not going to go into politics, but you just think it's not just one, it's all across the world. You just see, and it's from the top down. It just seems to be, it's just a seething pot of nastiness, but then it's up to people like yourselves, the good people, to to push back, and me. I'm saying I'm good.
It's all right.
It's up to us good people to to push back against that evil and just say it's not acceptable, and just to try and get the word out to people, just to watch themselves, and that it's.
And it's to what the information age with a cell phone, and you can click a picture of the person you're with, and send it to a friend, a trusted friend.
Yeah.
And that was one of my other things is the gay community itself, they created an environment of making it unsafe by a lot of the politics within there. Like, people tend to put people down who might have a more active sex life.
Mm-hmm.
And so people don't want to, if they want to keep that a secret, they don't tell their friends they're going on this hookup and this hookup.
Mm-hmm.
So they've got to get over their judgmental stick and just start making it a more sex positive, that people can talk honestly and without judgment.
Yeah, definitely be more open and like you say, not compartmentalized and segregate. This is another version of segregation, isn't it? Within communities and everything. That kind of thing. And we need those barriers that still need to be broken down everywhere to accept that and push that through. So when can this documentary be seen and where?
I think as of today, it's on streaming services. I think Amazon Prime, and there's a whole list.
Several documentary. DocBox, I think, is another one.
Oh, okay. Some
documentary services that are specializing in that. So,
Fantastic. And obviously, with through the distribution, you're going to have that full worldwide visibility of it as well. So the story is going to go worldwide. And it's a story that, like we've just been talking about for half an hour, so it's one that needs to be heard. And one, you know, just to say how remarkable it is that a little twist of fate, one coincidence, can make the world a better place. Because it's obviously you're still in it. You're still here. So that makes the world a better place by people like you guys still having that that one chance, you know, of getting away from something like that and being able to live your life. So,
and if we can get the message, getting the story out, just will make people more vigilant and make hopefully the world a safer place.
So. Definitely. Is there anything, I'm going to stop the recording, so is there anything you'd like to say as a last minute type thing to anybody who might be watching or listening?
Not for me. We should probably say thank you.
Well, yeah. There's a lot of people that need to be thanked. Like, I mean, you know, Billy, you know, and all the people that worked on the documentary were amazing. I mean, I did the music for it, which was a lot of, you know, very good. It was good for me, you know.
And the film festivals that we won 132 awards.
Wow.
Worldwide. That was sort of set the stage where it could be picked up by and distributed.
Yeah, Mark and the film boat guys, they've been great. I'm really happy about the way that it's been handled with really, like, you know, with kid gloves. Like, I mean, they've really done well to kind of not sensationalize it and to be, mm-hmm. you know, to be kind of grown up about the whole thing, right? You know, so it is good.
Yeah.
So fantastic. The tendency is to you know, to just be, it's all very sex, right? You know, like there's that stuff is it trivializes the real issue, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
and so we were really kind of worried that was going to be the way that it was going to be treated, but I'm happy that it's not.
Yeah, no, it's great. And I say, it sounds like Billy, also, I'll hopefully get to talk to Billy as well at some time. Yeah. Like his way from that perspective of making it, but to hear that it's been made with that is the respect and the dignity. And it's not because, yeah, that's another part of this world is all, you know, sex sells and, you know, and it's not the right story to tell. The story to tell is what you're saying. It's the emotion. It's the harrowing, the stress, the reality of living and moving on with your lives, knowing.
Yeah, healing is the goal, right?
Healing, you know, for that's thing. The one, yeah.
Yeah, and it really is. We made the sort of the agreement with Billy and the production team to not use MacArthur's name in the film, you know, as often as few times as possible, right? You know,
yeah.
And mostly just because we don't want the story to be about him. We want the story to be about the victims and the people who mm-hmm. were, you know, who that we've lost and the process of how you heal from something like that, you know, with the help of, you know, friends and family and community and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's the important message, I think.
Definitely. Friends, family, and communities. It's a lovely thing to end this as well. That's what it should be about. And that's the support that we still need to carry through, regardless of what we've, you know, the hate that we talk about in the world. That's where friends, family, and community is. That's the support we need to strengthen and promote. So yeah, that's a agree on that.
Thank you. I'll copyright that later.